As David mentioned earlier, I wrote this book called Senders. And after I wrote the book, I realized I wrote the wrong book. It's kind of a bummer, isn't it, after you put all that work in? And because what happened, the subtitle is, you know, how to identify and train and deploy missionaries from your church. And it was meant to be a very practical book on just how to surface missionaries in your church and how to get them out there. And I found out after I started distributing the book that a lot of pastors don't want to do this. And I just sort of assumed, because it's kind of ironic, because every church I go to, they're having me come in to speak because they want me to speak on missions. They all support missionaries, so they have a missions budget. They've got a board there that shows where all their missionaries are. You know, they have maybe a missions conference of some sort, and so they all love missionaries. But the amazing thing is that probably around 90% of churches that are like that have never sent a missionary from their church. And that's quite amazing that we would have that kind of intensity of love for missions, but yet we're not launching some of the people from our church. And so I want to talk on this subject this morning of being a sending church and maybe try to unearth some things that maybe are log jams in our own heart about thinking about being a sending church. We're kind of happy that other people are going, but not me. We're maybe willing to support missionaries from other churches, but we don't want to send one of ours. And so let's think about that subject for just a moment this morning. And to do so, we're going to go to Romans chapter 10, a very familiar passage of Scripture to you, and want to sort of highlight three issues. We're not going to spend too much time on the first two because we're going to jump to the third one, but let me first of all point that out to you. If a church doesn't want to send a missionary from their own congregation, first and foremost, it could be a heart issue. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying it could be, because that's where Paul's in this chapter begins. Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them, that is Israel, that they might be saved. And as we read that, it's a bit casual, but if we could read this in the language that Paul wrote it in, it's pretty intense. My heart's desire, it's actually the word that is translated oftentimes covet. Now, covet is normally not a good word in our world. We're not supposed to covet. But it's kind of a neutral word that can be used in one way or the other, positive or negative. And here it's in a positive way. He said, the thing that I covet, you know what it is in a negative way. When you're coveting something that you don't have that belongs to somebody else, there's almost an emotional attachment. It's something that drives you. And Paul uses that same word here. My heart's coveting is that they might be saved. And so part of our problem might be our heart really isn't that intense in this issue of the Great Commission of world evangelism. He uses the word prayer here. He says, not only my heart's desire or the covet, but also my prayer to God. It's not just the plain old word for prayer. It's a word for pleading. Getting on my knees and begging God is the idea behind this word. So as Paul writes here, it's full of emotion. It's full of heart. And he says, the thing that drives me, the thing that captures my heart, the thing that I covet, the thing that I have a passion for, is that fellow Jews might come to Christ. He had previously indicated in the same letter, he said, I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. I don't know how to process that verse. Do you? If I understand what Paul is saying there, he's saying, I'm willing to go to hell, if it were possible, for the sake of my brethren, for fellow Jews. I don't know about you, but I'm not there. I'm not sure I want to give up my seat in heaven. But what if I were so passionate about world evangelism that I was willing to make a statement? That's pretty radical. And as apostle to the Gentiles, God had given him a mission that he was supposed to reach Gentiles, but he could not get over the fact that he was a Jew and his countrymen, from his fellow nation, they were lost and going to hell. And he says, the thing that I covet the most, the thing that I'm passionate about, the thing that I beg of God, is to bring salvation to their hearts. He was passionate enough to be willing to die for the cause. And maybe that might be an indicator of why we're not more excited about sending our own people from our church. Maybe it's a heart issue. I don't know. You're going to have to decide that for yourself if that is the case. And if there's no desire on your part, probably one of the places you want to go to is your heart, for out of it all the issues of life come. But secondly, notice it could be a theological issue. Verse 2 says, I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God. Speaking of the Jewish nation now, they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. He says, these people have a zeal for God. And almost every place you go in the world, there are some places in South America and Europe where people are just sort of agnostic and atheistic, and they have no zeal for God. But the majority of the world's population has a zeal for a God. Not necessarily for the God of the Bible, but they have a zeal. And the passion with which they follow their religion makes us look almost backslidden. I was talking during the earlier hour about Indonesia, and one of the characteristics of that country is that it's 90%, almost 90% Muslim. And 4 o'clock in the morning, no matter where you are in that country, over the loudspeakers, they're going to blare the call to prayer. You can't sleep through it. Almost, I've never been any place in the country but what you hear it at 4 o'clock in the morning. And they don't have such a thing as noise pollution. They just blast it out over the loudspeakers. At 4 o'clock in the morning, people are going up and going to the mosque to pray. And multiple times throughout the day, they will go to pray. In the mosque in Jakarta, that the country we were talking about during the previous hour, 250,000 people can meet in that mosque to worship at one time. And oftentimes they fill that place. There's a passion. There's a zeal for God. But notice he says it's not according to knowledge. Well, what's the difference? Verse 3 just nails it. It basically draws a hard line between genuine faith in Jesus Christ and all the rest of the world's religions put together. Here's what it is. Being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God, they seek to establish their own. That basically just cuts to the core. It's the basic foundational difference between the gospel of Jesus Christ and all the other world's religions. Call it whatever you want. All the rest of the world's religions are basically a way or a system by which you establish your own righteousness. It's basically, if I do this, this, and this, then I'll be right with God, maybe. And if I do this and that, and so they come up with these lists of things that you got to do. And every religion has their list. Some of them are similar. Some of them are totally different from each other. But you can take a look at any of the world's religions anywhere around the world, and basically it has something to do with establishing your own righteousness. Because all of us understand we're not good enough. So somehow I've got to be good enough to get to God. And so over the centuries, man has come up with these systems, with these religions that say, okay, if you do this, you're going to establish your own righteousness. Then the next guy comes along and says, no, you got to do this to establish your own righteousness. All of those are basically not what the gospel is. The gospel simply says you can't do it. You can't establish your own righteousness. You'll never be good enough. So therefore, you need to be clothed with the righteousness of Christ, that was where he paid the penalty for my sin on the cross. He was buried. He rose again. I can have forgiveness of sin, so that as God looks at me, he looks through the screen of Jesus Christ, who established my righteousness, not because I'm righteous, but because Jesus was righteous. That is the gospel message. And that's the antithesis to all the rest of the world's religions. So that is sort of, this is just basic foundational, gospel. Now, the amazing thing is that in the evangelical world, there's a lot of debate about this. You know, it used to be only the liberals tossed out the gospel. We're living in an era right now where the evangelical world is struggling with trying to define what the gospel is. And it surfaces in quite a few different ways, and we're not going to get into all of those right now. But the point is, evangelicals are debating whether human beings really are lost if they don't believe in Jesus Christ. They're questioning Jesus when he says, I am the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And they're saying, could that really be true that those Baggio people that we talked about in the previous hour who have never heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, could they possibly be going to hell? And that's being debated today. Well, you see, once you jettison the gospel, once you jettison the exclusivity of the gospel of Jesus Christ, there really isn't any more reason for missions. So it really is a theological issue. You know, once we abandon the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the fact that that people are lost without the gospel, once you abandon that, there really isn't any reason for missions. So maybe, just maybe, we don't really believe the gospel. Maybe, just maybe, we don't really believe that man is lost without Christ. Because if you don't really believe that, we can go through the motions of missions, but it's really not that important. Or we'll redefine what missions is, and it's doing a lot of good things out there, but it never gets around to giving the gospel because we don't really believe that anyway. So the gospel and its exclusivity are foundational to the reason why you get involved in missions. If you really believe that the Baggio are lost, just maybe it might surface an interest in doing something about them. So Paul goes on and discusses this issue, verses 3 through 12, and we're not going to delve into that right now because I really wanted to jump to the third one, the third point that I want to make here. First, if we're not interested in sending out missionaries, it could be a hard issue. Maybe I've grown cold. Maybe you really believe the gospel and you've come to Christ, but your heart just isn't there. The passion and the desire, the coveting and the begging are just not there. But when a congregation gets to the place where they are starting to beg God, where they're coveting that the gospel of Jesus Christ would emanate from our building, then it starts to change our perception of whether we want to send a missionary or not. Or if we don't really believe what the Bible says, we're not convinced that we ought to spend our life abandoning some kind of a lifestyle that we can have here in America to live over there if we don't really believe what the Bible says. So it could be a hard issue, could be a theological issue, but I think probably in many churches that I go to and that you're familiar with, it may not necessarily be so much a theological issue. We really believe that, but it hasn't reached our heart. But really, it might just be a practical issue. Paul put it this way, and what I want you to do is to think of a row of dominoes. Use that as the illustration. You've done that as a kid. Dominoes is a real game, you know, you can play, but most of us, all we do is line them up and knock them over. You know, so, and you can line them up and you can line up thousands of these things. And to get the last one to fall, all you got to do is tip the first one over. Well, Paul sort of sets up a row of dominoes here. Notice what he says. How then will they call on him whom they have not believed? We want that domino to fall. We want people around the world to believe in Jesus Christ. Well, how is that going to happen? There's a domino that needs to hit that first. How then will they believe in whom they have not heard? There has to be the declaration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. No, believing in a God is not enough. Every place around the world that I go, there's a zeal for God. People believe in a God, except for a few places where there's a bunch of atheists. But majority of the world, they believe in a God. But if they've never heard the name of Jesus, they are not saved. Well, what domino knocks that one over? Number three, how will they hear without someone preaching? In other words, someone has to go say this. Someone needs to go declare the gospel. It's not going to happen unless that happens. But the one that we sort of kicks the whole thing off, the first domino that we need to push is the fourth one here. How are they to preach unless they are sent? The chain reaction that has to start is somebody has to put their finger on the first domino and push it. Somebody needs to do the sending. You say, well, maybe it's a problem of people not volunteering to go. May I just sort of flip that on its head a little bit for you to think a little bit differently? Maybe we don't have churches that really want to send. Maybe we don't really have churches that have a passionate for launching people out of our congregation to go to the mission field. Maybe it's as simple as that we don't really want to send. let me ask you for just a moment. Why did you join this church? Or why do you come here if you haven't joined yet? I mean, I assume there may be another church or two in town that you could go to, but you chose this one. Think for just a moment. What was sort of the tipping point for why you came to this church? Was it any of these? Maybe you didn't like the music down the street, but you do like the music here. Hey, by the way, thanks for the djembe drum. I grew up in Africa. I went to sleep listening to this all, you know, every night. So thanks. But man, when they drum, they know how to make that thing talk. So thanks for having the djembe drum. Maybe the preaching here, you really like it. And down the street, well, it's not so great. But I understand you preach for like an hour. So it must be something good for people to come and listen to you for an hour. And listen, just because I'm going to preach a little bit shorter this morning, I don't want to spoil you here, but it's just that he's a lot smarter than me. So I don't know what else to say. You know, man, a few words. So don't get spoiled here this morning. Just realize that it's normal to go for over an hour. Okay. I'm abnormal. So maybe you just find this such an encouraging, it's a family atmosphere. You come here and you're supported, and you just know there's a place that people care for you and love you, and it's just a great place to be. And you get all beat up during the week, and then you come here and sort of get, I mean, these are all good reasons, aren't they, for coming to this church. But you know, all of these things that are listed on the board are all part of good ecclesiology. What a church needs to do. But the question is, why does this church exist? Not what it does, not what are the physical manifestations that you might see that are kind of attractive to you, but answering the question why. And that's what I missed in my book. I should have written that book first, though I found other books that already talk about this, so I don't need to write the book. Because until you understand the why, there's no need dealing with the what. Until you understand why this church exists, all the rest of this stuff is just kind of superficial. The driving force behind the church has to be the fulfillment of what God has told us to do. We call that the Great Commission. I wrote an article a while back that was published in a magazine, and it was entitled "Cancel the Missions Program." Now, it's a little bit odd to come from a guy that leads a mission organization. I've been in mission my whole life. And spent the last 25 years here in the States leading a mission organization. So obviously my life is missions. And I wrote this article, Cancel the Missions Program. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, when you put an S on the end of a word, it normally means what? More than one. Missions program. I know we probably don't mean that, but it could imply that missions is one of the many other things that we do. Or when we use the word program, we think of a music program and a children's program and a VBS program and a Christmas program, we've got all these programs. Oh yeah, we better add missions as a program. And so it becomes a subdivision of the church. And obviously I'm biased. I hope scripturally biased in the right direction to say that mission, creating a singular mission, is the driving force of all the rest of the stuff that we do. And all the rest of our programs are designed to accomplish that one mission. And there's not a bunch of missions that we're supposed to do. There is one mission, and that is to make disciples of Jesus Christ all over the planet. Until every person has heard the gospel, we have not finished our mission for planet Earth. So missions is not a subset of one of many programs. It is, if you will, the program. It is the agenda. It is the why we exist. So once we start to wrestle with that and understand we've got a reason for existence, yes, we enjoy the children's program. Yes, we love the worship times, the music, the preaching. We love all of these kinds of things. They're good. They're all part of what a good, strong church needs to be. But over all of that has to be this driving force, this big idea that we are here to make disciples of people all over planet Earth. And when that becomes your agenda, then all the rest of this stuff down here starts to have meaning. Otherwise, everything starts turning in. We become consumers. And we come to church because this is what I want to get out of church rather than what I want to give. And I'm joining a church not because they have the agenda of reaching the world, but because my kids are going to be in a nice youth group. And I want my kids to be in a good youth group, and we want to have good youth groups. But why do we do good youth groups? There has to be a bigger why. And so once we wrestle that issue to the ground, we can begin then to accomplish what God wants us to. So I was never in the military, but in the military world, I think they probably understand this maybe a lot better than many of us. You know, in the military world, they understand mission. The commander says, take that hill. And so they understand. Everything we do has to be about taking that hill. All of our training, all of our equipment, all of our energy, all of our focus, all of our planning, everything is about taking that hill. And that's basically the way we need to approach church. Why are we here? There's a hill that God gave us to conquer. We understand the mission, so we throw all of our energies into accomplishing that so that all of our activities align with that. Last year, put new tires on my car. I got 90,000 miles out of those tires. And it's not because I'm such a good driver, but I think what happened was when I bought the car, I bought a lifetime alignment with Firestone. So with that lifetime alignment, you can take your car in. You can take it in every day if you want. They have to align it. And so I would meticulously, every time I changed the oil, they would align the tires. They had to. They were part of the contract. And I think part of the reason why those tires lasted so long was I kept them rotated and aligned. Now, you get a lot of mileage when you treat them right. Now, the same thing happens with the church. When you understand what the mission is and everything is aligned to that mission, you're going to go a lot further, a lot faster, and you're not going to have the wobbles in your steering wheel. And one of the reasons why churches have problems is because everybody thinks that the mission is in a different direction. And I have my pet direction, and you have your pet direction, and we think the church ought to be this and ought to do that. And all of us are sort of going in 10 different directions. You know what happens when tires are out of alignment? They wear out quickly. You start feeling the wobble in the steering wheel, and they don't last very long. Churches that can bring themselves into alignment with the mission of the church, and they all agree, here's why we're here. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. That is the kind of church that's going to get down the road a lot further than the next. The church is not an end to itself. It's a process of creating those who can fulfill the great commission of Jesus Christ. There are basically three groups of people in the church that can push that first domino. I'd like to talk about those. In other words, if we're going to be a sending church, and if we want this chain reaction to take place, if we want people to respond to the gospel down here, what are the pieces that have to fall before that? Who is it that pushes that first domino? I'd like to suggest that there are probably three people or groups of people in this church that can put their finger on that first domino. The first are those of you that are parents. Parents can be domino pushers. My dad was a missionary in Nigeria, and he went there single and found my mom on the mission field. Back in those days, a lot of people did this. They went there single because they were afraid to get married to somebody because they would derail them from getting to the mission field. And so they would go to the mission field and get married there. My parents got married on the mission field. They didn't even bother coming back. My mom had a wedding dress, or she found one somewhere. I guess she went in faith believing she'd find somebody. But here we are in, you know, remote Africa. They found each other and they got married. And that's where I grew up. I grew up on the mission field in Nigeria, where my parents were missionary church planters among very primitive people. Well, my dad says one of the primary reasons he became a missionary was this. My grandfather was a Swedish immigrant, moved to this country as a teenager, went to South Dakota. A farmer had paid his passage over because they needed farmhands. So the idea was he had to work for a number of years, I forget how many. And then once he had worked off those years, then he was free to go do whatever he wanted to do. And so my granddad came over as a Swedish immigrant to work on a farm in South Dakota. ended up working off the time that he needed to pay off his passage and married the farmer's daughter, started his own farm. Well, my granddad was a godly man and very passionate about missions. And so their church would have missionaries come through, and he would always ask them to come out to the farm, at least for a meal, if not to stay with them for a few days. And so oftentimes missionaries, my dad would say, would come out to the farm and stay there for a few days before they headed off to their next meetings. And the missionaries might work a little bit in the, you know, on the farm with my granddad. And then in the evenings, they'd sit around a table. And because this is before electricity, there was nothing to do in the evening other than sit around the dining room table and talk. And my dad would sit there and listen to these stories from missionaries all over the world as they talked about what God was doing on the mission fields of the world. And my dad said, it was because my grandfather, his father, had this passion for missions and exposed him to missions that it gave him the trajectory by which God called him into his ministry. Now, that's a little bit counterintuitive for parents to want this. I mean, why would you want to send your kids halfway around the world? It's counterintuitive for us to let go of our kids. And, you know, we sort of want them to hang around and be here. We don't want them living in some godforsaken corner of the planet that's dangerous. And so we tend to want to hang on to our kids. And we want to send them off to get a good education so they can get a good job, so maybe they don't have to struggle quite as much as we did financially. And it's just counterintuitive for us to want our kids to be missionaries. Why would anybody want to put your kids in harm's way on some place around the planet? Jesus put it this way. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Those are pretty strong words, aren't they? Not sure I know how to process that entirely. Whoever does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. In Mark, he says something very similar. He says, there's no man that hath left house or brethren or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake in the Gospels. And he talks about those kinds of people. Part of our growing up was, because my parents were living in a very remote place in Nigeria, there were no schools, much less schools in English. And so there were no schools. We were at the end of the road. We were in a very primitive situation. So we went to boarding school. And I realize that it's kind of a horrific idea today for many of us that you'd want to send your kids to boarding school. Though probably some days you'd like to send them to boarding school, right? But normally we don't want to think in terms of sending our kids off. But from 7 years old on, all the way through high school, during the school year, I was off at boarding school. Get on a mission airplane and fly into the boarding school. We'd be away from our parents. And I realized that in today's world, we don't necessarily have to do that anymore. We've got homeschooling, we've got a bunch of other stuff that it's not necessary so much anymore, though there are a few boarding schools still around the world for missionary kids. But my parents knew what to do with that verse. They said, if sending our kids to boarding school is part of getting the gospel to these people in this village, we're willing to make that sacrifice. And I guess I never really understood it as a kid growing up, but as a parent sending my daughter off to college, all of a sudden the lights came on, I understood. And it was my daughter going off to college, not to first grade at 7 years old. I began to understand that the greater sacrifice was on the part of my parents who were willing to release us to the care of a boarding school, and they couldn't be there on a daily basis for us. And I'm not suggesting you need to do that. I'm not suggesting that's what we need to do today, that that's the pattern or you need to do that. All I'm saying is they read those verses and they said, this is part of the Great Commission. And Jesus talked about people that would leave mother and father, wife, children, lands for his sake and for the gospel's. Somebody may just have to do that. And we can't be a sending church unless we're willing to do that. And so that's why I say the first ones that can probably push this domino are the parents and the grandparents. And I realize what I'm talking about. It's a tough thing for us to do that. This is not an easy task. This is not just something we ought to be nonchalant about. But somebody's going to have to put their kids and their grandkids on an airplane and send them 8,000 miles away if we're going to fulfill the mission of the church. That's part of the sacrifice. The future of missions is going to be fueled by parents who say it loud and clear and often that their greatest aspiration for their kids is Great Commission work. It'll happen because parents model evangelism and discipleship as a priority in their life. It'll happen because parents take their kids to visit the mission field so that they get exposure. It'll happen when you invite missionaries into your home and let missionaries be with your kids so that they can begin to catch the vision and see what God is doing around the world. It'll happen when your family devotional time is dominated by intercession for the peoples of the world. And it may just happen when missionaries tell their stories around your dinner table. It may happen because you stock the bookshelves and the video libraries of your home with missionary biographies. It may happen when you replace sports heroes with missionary heroes. You see, a lot of this has to do with us as parents. Now, you as a parent may be going to the mission field. And we shouldn't exclude that possibility, regardless of your age. We talked a little bit about this in the previous hour. This is not an age-restricted issue anymore. At any age, you could be going to the mission field. But if you're going to launch a generation of missionaries, a great place to start is in your family, where you as parents say, this is going to be a priority for us to do this. And I know the sacrifice of having empty chairs around the Christmas dinner table. And I know the sacrifice of not having kids there and the grandkids for Thanksgiving. And for being months away from personal relatives. This is part, but you see, the cause that we're talking about is far greater than any personal sacrifice that we may make here on planet Earth. And so, parents, grandparents, you can have your finger poised at that first domino. You could help to push that first domino. And if this church is going to send out missionaries, maybe part of your responsibility here in this church is to get your kids ready and get yourself ready to let go of them. The second domino pusher in the church is the pastor. There obviously has to be a commitment from the pastor's side to do this. Unfortunately, you guys have a pastor that is committed to, two pastors that are committed to this. So I'm preaching to the choir here. But I just want to underscore to you that you have a pastor. In fact, he prayed about this earlier. I don't know whether you caught that or not. He wants this to happen. And when it boils down to it, it really is almost this simple. If a church wants it to happen, it'll probably happen. But if the pastor doesn't want it to happen, it may not. J.D. Greer wrote a book called Gaining by Losing, and he argues that the future belongs to the churches that send, or that have an open hand, that are willing to let missionaries and people go. And in chapter 9, he entitles that chapter, Your Church Doesn't Need a Missions Pastor. In other words, a lot of churches, you know, they get a pastor and a youth pastor, a music guy, and then they get a missions pastor, somebody that can give full time. And basically, he's arguing in that chapter, the pastor ought to be the missions pastor. In other words, the chief missiologist of the church ought to be the pastors of the churches, not mission agencies, not the profs at colleges. It ought to be the pastors. Because key to a church being a sending church is whether or not the pastor wants it. This year, we conducted five think tanks with pastors around the United States. So we gathered together a group of guys, a group of pastors, and we spent a day just talking about some of these concepts. And one of the things that we did was, over and over again, we asked them, why would you not want to be a sending church? And I sort of compiled them into 10 different reasons. This is not me talking. These are pastors telling me this is the reason. Number one, insecurity. They feel that if they train other people, maybe they'll do it better than them. Maybe someone can preach shorter than you. maybe someone can preach better. And there's insecurity. And believe it or not, there's insecurity on the part of pastors that if we train people to be good leaders, I might be out of a job. Other pastors said, well, because we're self-focused, we're trying to build an empire, and we don't want to let go of our key leaders. I mean, what if you had Paul and Barnabas as members of this church? Would you want them to go? Of course not. You'd want them to stay and be a part of this church. They'd leave a big vacuum. I mean, who's going to do the giving and counseling if Barnabas isn't here? Who's our great expositor and theologian if Paul isn't here? And so there was, I'm sure, some in that church at Antioch who were saying, wait, this doesn't make sense. Let go of Paul and Barnabas? And so if you're trying to build an empire, yeah, missions doesn't make sense. Other pastors basically admitted, we don't train leaders because we're perfectionists. We don't think anybody else can do it as good as us. Other pastors said they just don't have time. And your expectations on your pastors maybe are so high of other stuff that they're supposed to do that they don't have time to train leaders and to develop the next generation of missionaries. But if you're aligning yourself with the mission, that the Great Commission drives us, you'll be willing to forgo some of their time for things that maybe will benefit you to benefit the cause instead. Others admitted that one of the reasons they don't send missionaries is because of cost. It does cost. It eats into your budget. Not only does it eat into your budget, the type of person that you send normally is a good giver. So not only do you lose income, it actually costs you to support him. And so you're getting hit double by sending a missionary from your church. It does cost. No question about that. Another reason they gave is they just don't have the vision for it. No desire. We got everything running good here. Don't mess things up. Another was just not being aware that this is part of what the pastor's job description is. Ephesians 4, there's several places you can go to get the pastor's job description in the New Testament. One of the classic places is Ephesians 4, 11 and 12, where it says that the pastor's job is to train you to do the work of the ministry. And his role is to equip you. And if you just hire a pastor so he can do all the work for you, you've missed the idea. The idea is that he is here to equip you to do the ministry. Others have said, it's just not our priority. It's not something that we think is all that important. And so if you don't think it's that important, you're not going to spend time and money and effort to accomplish it. And so pastors have to have their finger poised on that domino. And we've heard from pastors this year as we've traveled around the United States and talked with pastors that for many of them, they're pulling their finger back. They don't want to push that first domino. And it's understandable. I'm not being critical. And I'm just telling you what they say, not any criticism from my side. But this is a tough thing. It's hard for parents to let go of kids. It's hard for grandparents to let go of grandkids. It's hard for pastors to let go of people from their congregation. This is hard stuff. But there's a third group of people in the church that could have their finger poised on this domino, and that is all of you. So this sort of catches everybody, all right? In case I missed anybody, the first two, the last one is the catch-all. Let's go to Acts chapter 13. Now, there were in the church at Antioch prophets and teachers, and he lists them. There's Barnabas, Simeon, who's called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, a member of the court of Herod, the Tetrarch, and Saul. And while they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work unto which I have called them. And then after fasting and praying, they laid their hands on them, and they sent them off. Let me ask you a couple of questions, see if you can come up with the answer here from this text. First question, when God wanted missionaries, where did he go to get them? This isn't a trick question, okay? Just read the text. When God wanted missionaries, where did he go to get them? The church. There was a church in Antioch. So in the city of Antioch, a real city, a real church, a congregation of people like you that were meeting together, he went to a local church. Now, those of us in mission agencies, where do you think we go to find missionaries? Bible colleges, seminaries. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Because at a Bible college and seminary, you're finding people that are preparing for the ministry. So that kind of makes sense for us to go there. But there's two issues that we have to address. One is we can't bypass the local church. And it's easy for parachurch organizations like ours to simply neglect the local church. And so what oftentimes happens is organizations, mission agencies send representatives to Bible college. They recruit somebody. They go join the mission agency. They decide where they're going to go. Then they come back to the local church and say, by the way, I'm going to Indonesia. Would you just write the check? And you had nothing to do with this whole thing. And they bypass the local church. That ought not to be. You as a local church need to be engaged in this process. Why? Because missionaries come from local churches. They don't come from Bible colleges. Bible colleges are simply a way to help equip people to go to the mission field. They all come from a local church. And so we don't want to bypass the local church. So the Spirit of God says to the local church, here's a couple of guys that I want to go to the mission field. Question number two. What group of people in that church did the Spirit of God pick on or choose? Just kind of give me a general category. Pastors, leaders. Okay? It lists them for us. Here are the guys that are providing leadership for the church. Now, it uses kind of a technical term here of these men, and it's actually the word, as they ministered, that word ministered, it's kind of a technical term that from which we get the word civil servant. Now, civil servant back in those days, not so much today, we pay people salaries, but back in those days, a civil servant was someone who worked as a volunteer for their community, for their city, for their state, for whatever. So it was a volunteer. So maybe it doesn't say, but we might presume that the people here that are listed in verse 1 were not on the paid pastoral staff, but they were leaders in the church. They were civil servants, if you will, of the local church. They were volunteer workers in the local church. They had full-time jobs, but yet they were ministering in the local church. And it wasn't the teenagers. And we need to try to equip our young people and prepare them for missions. I've already argued that. But we also need to think in terms of the fact that maybe we need to, in addition to sending Timothy and Titus to the mission field, we also need to send Paul and Barnabas to the field. Paul at this particular time had already been a Christian for 14 years. Now, before that, he had already studied a lot of theology, so he had a lot of background. So this was not a young man. It was not a novice. Paul knew what he was talking about by this time. And so it was Paul and Barnabas, key leaders in the church that God sent. Now, let me ask you another question from this text. To whom is the Spirit of God speaking in verse 2? Possibly a better question would be this. To whom is the Spirit of God not speaking? Just read the text. It's not complicated. It's not a trick question. The Holy Spirit said, set apart for me, Paul and Barnabas, for the work to which I have called them. Who's he not talking to? Paul and Barnabas. Now that's a little bit incongruous. That doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, if Paul and Barnabas are supposed to be the missionaries, they ought to be the one feeling the call. I mean, if anybody has a chill going down their spine, it ought to be Paul and Barnabas, not the rest of them. But whoever this was, whether the Spirit of God was impressing on the heart of the leadership or the whole congregation, maybe you could argue both sides. But the point is, it wasn't the missionaries, it was the congregation that identified the fact that Paul and Barnabas needed to go. What if you as a congregation made that one of your agendas? That you started praying that God would raise up missionaries from your congregation. And that was just a daily prayer. Lord, we want to send somebody from this congregation to somewhere around the world. Then when you get together on Sunday morning, you're shaking hands with people. Guess what? Back of your mind, you're thinking, is it him? Is it her? Who's the next person? Someone here is the next person to be a missionary from this church. Who is it? And it's part of your job to explore that and to try to discern who that is. And the call of God upon our lives is not a solo act where I just raise my hand and say, okay, I'll go. It is a congregational collectivist decision where you as a congregation identify in an individual their qualifications and their readiness and the fact that God's hand is on this individual. And maybe this is the person that we need to send. And so I come full circle back to where we started. Why do we not get missionaries on the field? Because there aren't senders. There has to be a congregation that says, we want to send, and we're going to practically put into motion some things to send people from our congregation. We want to be a sending church. It's almost just that simple. And when you get to your place to where you're saying, this is part of what we want to be, this is part of what we want to do, and we'll keep supporting missionaries from other churches, but we want some of our own, it'll start changing the way you look at one another. It'll start changing what you do on Sundays and throughout the week as you're being discipled and as you're being trained and as you're going through all that you do as a church, because you're saying all of this is in preparation for maybe someday God would thrust me onto the mission field somewhere. And all of a sudden now there comes meaning and purpose for what you're doing. It's not just to go through the motions on a Sunday. We're driving towards a cause. And we want to send somebody from this congregation to the mission field. Sending missionaries is not something that's restricted to big churches. You'd kind of think that that might be the case. But the reality is, smaller churches send far more missionaries than big churches do. Don't be intimidated by the size of any church. That's not the issue. Some of the most missionary-minded churches are churches of 30 people. And churches that I was a while back up in Michigan, and I was visiting this church that I'd heard about that really had an intensity in missions, and I just knew they support a lot of missionaries, and they had produced a lot of missionaries. And I asked the pastor, how many missionaries have you guys sent? And he said, well, I don't know exactly for missions, but for ministry, and one sort of ministry or another, he said, we can trace over the last 3 or 4 decades 300 people. This is a church of 100 people. I don't think they'd ever been over 100 people. Why? Because they kept sending people out. But here was a church that wanted that to happen, and they weren't concerned about how big their church was. They were concerned about how big the kingdom of, the church of Jesus Christ was. And so this is sort of a different paradigm for many of us to process and think through. I understand that. But my purpose for being here this morning is to try to encourage you to start thinking, if you haven't already, in terms of this, that somebody needs to be the next missionary from this congregation. And somebody's going to be behind them, and somebody's going to be behind them. But if it's going to happen, somebody has to be poised with their finger on this domino that Paul talked about. Either you parents, or the pastors, or the whole congregation gets behind this thing of finding the next missionary from this church. So that would be my encouragement to you. I applaud you for focusing on missions during this Christmas season when most of our thoughts go in different directions. But the fact that you guys are focused on the Great Commission during this time of year indicates that you're already heading this direction. And it's only a matter of time till the next person is launched from this church to be a missionary. It's going to be exciting to see who that is. And you ought to, with great excitement and anticipation, look forward to identifying who that person is and then pick the next person, start working on them. And may God just provide a constant flow of people from these four walls to the mission fields of the world.